Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. On the 1st of June in 1878, the official day of trading began on the Tokyo Stock Exchange. The first listed instruments on the stock exchange were government bonds and not actually shares. But by the end of that year, the end of the trading year, or the calendar year rather, only four companies had been listed on the Tokyo Exchange. Today, that is one of the largest exchanges in the world. Well, markets certainly have changed over the course of several years, and clearly this is where we reflect on those moments. I'm Jimmy Muyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we speak to the chairperson of the Financial and Fiscal Commission, also former Finance Minister of South Africa, in Mr. Nhlanhla Nene. He joins me on the line to take a look at the purpose of this appointment and what it is that the president expects of this Financial and Fiscal Commission. We also have a conversation with the Spur Group and the Exaro Resources Limited Group. Both businesses reported on numbers. We're going to speak to the respective chief executives of those businesses, get a sense of how it is each business has fared. Then we have a conversation with the team at Standard Bank on their smart ID enablement partnership with the Department of Home Affairs, reaching more than 100 branches already. We're going to see how it is that that rollout has been unfolding and where to next for the Standard Bank business in regards to that. And then, because it is Thursday, we've got a small business conversation to be had. We're going to speak to the founder and CEO of a company called Mobilize and get a sense of what it is that they do.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
That's where we kick off the show, as we always do, with a sense of market movements that have been moving, or that have been taking place rather, throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Senior Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, to take a look at markets and see if we can make sense of them. Nicholas, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The Rand strong, crypto's going through the roof, commodity prices up, the oil prices up, but it doesn't seem like anyone really cares at this point, except the equity markets. They're not having a great day at all.
Yes, evening, Jimmy. Interesting markets. Interesting markets is one way of putting it. And I think we can sort of stem it back to what happened in the last few days when you had Treasury Secretary Mr. Scott Bessent. He basically surprised the markets by announcing, some form of a new version of QE. The exact wording was he's going to double the size of long bond-dated buyback operations. And the market took that as a cue to dive into the cryptos, dive back into gold, into PGMs, all the rest of it, what we saw. But yeah, I mean, to your point, broader market, though, still worrying about and fretting what's happening offshore. Local markets were generally choppy session, but yeah, otherwise a fairly yucky sort of day, really.
Nick, let's take a look at some other announcements out of the US. We got FOMC minutes yesterday and that FOMC conversation. But alongside that as well, we got some comments from President Trump. Anything stand out to you there that might have had the market spooked? I didn't note anything that really had a significant bearing on the dollar or any movements there, beyond, of course, what you mentioned around Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, which already started to move the markets yesterday. But after that, towards the tail end last night, did anything else surprise you?
Nothing major, but unless you really sort of looked around, and if you, it might have passed the average person who doesn't really watch the markets. But U.S. total debt just broke through $40 trillion in the early hours of this morning. There's actually a sort of a, and this is the Fed's and the Treasury's official numbers, so it's as accurate as it gets. So in the early hours of this morning, the U.S. total debt surpassed $40 trillion. If you actually want to look at the different numbers that make up that, it's about $116,000 of debt per every single person in America. So that might be a little bit of it. That's making a few headlines around the financial channels as well. And then again, tie that in with what I said about Mr. Bessent. And there's real concerns now about inflation in America. And there's also concerns now about this U.S. debt pile and, of course, what that means for the dollar. And that might be what the market is sort of grappling with at the moment.
That's quite interesting that you bring that up, Nick, because if I'm not mistaken, the current debt ceiling sits at $41.1 trillion, which $1 trillion isn't much headroom.
But we'll do it in a couple of days.
Yeah, we can do that, right? But it's also important to consider that this debt ceiling that the US speaks of has been increased on 79 different occasions since 1960 alone. So in the last, 65, 66 odd years, it's moved up almost 80 times. A clear sign that the US debt problem is not something that's going away anytime soon. But markets, obviously, I suppose, that psychological level that you allude to around that $40 trillion level, President Trump's administration has probably added a significant amount to that with the wars that, according to them, they're not waging, I guess.
Yeah, it's about eight, if you really want to be accurate, in the last sort of two terms that he's been running. It really is a frightening number, Jimmy. I mean, it's you know, the funny thing is, you know, they just keep kicking this can down the road. And as long as I have been in the markets, everyone's calling for the demise of the dollar and the dollar as a reserve currency. It's going to end. That's every time tuned. It never seems to happen. They just keep churning away. But you do get a sense that sort of outside of the headlines, people are taking a little bit more of a negative approach to America. I mean, the thing that spooked the market about a week or so ago was a traditional sort of weekly auction, 10-year bonds. You know, what happens is the U.S. government has an auction, people come with their bids, they take on the debt, and it's really nothing so special at all. It's just, it occurs all the time. But what happened this time around is that the market out of nowhere sort of said, well, actually, you know, to buy American debt, I want to be rewarded a little bit more. I don't want to pay 5%. I want to pay 5.2 or 5.3. And in fact, 5.35 was one of the bids that came in. And that really spooked the markets, because all of a sudden, you know, we do get a feeling that this debt is going to start to matter. And if you pivot that back to what you said, Jimmy, with regards to the debt ceiling, you know, they've got to then raise this debt ceiling once again. It seems to be every other month they do it. But not so simple anymore, because midterm elections coming up. You've got, you know, how much support does Mr. Trump have to get this debt ceiling raised through? So things are starting to get a little bit tricky. And I think you're seeing it play out in these debt markets, certainly first and foremost, yeah.
Nick, can we take a look at the gold price back above $4,500 a fine ounce? Lovely,
yes,
to see it there. We haven't been here since June, July-ish, since we came down below the $4,500 level. We bounced very nicely off $4,000 a fine ounce. We're now chasing down what looks like $5,000, potentially even higher than that. Might be too soon to call $5,000 a fine ounce, but we're only $500 away, really.
Yes. Baby steps, Jimmy. We can't spook the markets just yet. And if you look at the other PGM, I mean, the lesser forgotten ugly stepchild, which is silver, that was up at like 4% at one point today too. So again, all this coming off these blowing out yields, worried about inflation, all the rest of it. And this is actually quite good news for SA, actually, because this is the Rand is obviously strengthening a little bit off it. It didn't do a great deal to do, but it's only, you know, you talk about gold being $500 away. Well, the Rand is literally 11 cents away from that 16 level. If we do get a 15 handle on the Rand, which I think we probably will, that's very good for our friends in Pretoria, the MPC, that takes the sort of sting out of inflation a little bit. And overall, that's good for our rands and our bonds. So, you know, despite, you know, our intro not looking great with these red markets, I think overall the picture starts to look a little bit better for us here in South Africa. Always the optimist, remember.
I love it, Nick. And that's what I love about you. We're 11 cents away from breaking 16 Rand. That's what we need to see in the markets. Hopefully we see it by next week or even by the end of the month. Nick and I will catch up on that if that does happen, and when it does happen. Let's put that out there. Rather, we'll leave the conversation on that note for now. Senior Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, joining us to take a look at markets and what seems to be moving them.
35 years ago, we started asking a simple question. What if change wasn't something to survive, but something to invest in? Markets have risen and fallen. Technology has rewritten the rules. The world has shifted in ways nobody predicted. Through it all, we kept investing with conviction for the long term, for you. Change is opportunity. We're always ready to invest in it. 91, investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations. Greater adaptability. Long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think NetBank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know? Soil health is about more than nutrients. It's also about the physical, biological, and chemical properties that determine what's happening below the surface. With Omnia's Nutriology model, producers get a clear picture of their soil, so every recommendation starts with better insight. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
On Tuesday, the president of the country, President Cyril Ramaphosa, in terms of Section 221 of the Constitution and Section 8 of the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, appointed members of the Financial and Fiscal Commission to carry out their work over the next 5 years. We're going to be taking a look at this in greater detail with the chairperson of the commission, a gentleman that we might all be very familiar with, served a little under three decades as a member of the National Assembly. In that time, also served as Deputy Minister and Minister of Finance for the Republic of South Africa. I'm joined on the line by Ntate Nhlanhla to take a look at these developments and see if we can make sense of them. Ntate Nene, lovely having you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time. Allow me to be the first to say congratulations. Curious congratulations that after almost a decade out of public service, you've returned to public finance. What prompted you to say yes? I mean, I suppose a call from the president could have definitely helped that conversation along.
Thank you, Jimmy, and greetings to your listeners. Indeed, very good question. I actually was looking at my very close retirement in the corporate. Because in 3 years' time, I was going to be taking, hanging my boots, so to speak, in the corporate space. But when the call came, I really was very reluctant to say yes. But I felt it would not be fair not to actually give a little bit of my, make a little bit of my contribution in my last few years. After having served the public in the past, and with most of the legislation in this space also having been part of its drafting, and so I felt that if there is a need and if they feel that I'm the right person to fix, let me rather take up the responsibility and do my bit.
Ntatenene, as the chairperson of the Financial and Fiscal Committee, I understand, of course, that the committee hasn't had the opportunity to meet as yet, but can you give us a sense of the directive that has been tasked to you and the committee and the commission by the president? We know that this commission forms a critical part of policy and decision making within our financial and fiscal policy framework. As the new chairperson, what have the objectives been outlined to you that you and the commission aim to achieve? If you can share some of those.
Look, maybe let me start by making that disclaimer that I actually haven't even set foot in office. Even the formalities have not been finalized also with regards to my onboarding, except the announcement and, of course, that I have accepted the appointment. But as you've correctly pointed out, this is a very critical institution in our fiscal framework, which is established in terms of Section 220 of the Constitution and the Fiscal Framework Commission Act of 99, Act 99 of 97, with a few amendments. But our primary objective being to actually advise Parliament and also to actually make a meaningful contribution in the crafting, especially of the Division of Revenue, amongst the spheres of government. So, and that's a very important area, because in executing You know, it's fiscal responsibilities. Those things have to be taken into account. And these are challenging times indeed. You know, tight fiscal space, but at the same time, ever-growing needs of society. And also challenges with regard to how those finances are deployed and spent finally. So we have a responsibility to make sure that our research also is enhanced to give a real effect to sound advice that would actually make sure that we are able to advise committees, advise even state organs that actually are responsible for spending and receiving public funds.
Before I let you go, I want to take a look at what the Commission could potentially bring to an all-important conversation that will be taking place, or that we anticipate to have some feedback on in a couple of months. We got confirmation from the Minister of Finance at the start of the year when he tabled his budget speech that we will be getting a principle-based fiscal anchor by the midterm budget policy statement. And I understand, of course, that your role has yet to take effect here, but I'd like you to put on your other hats that you've previously worn and draw on the experience that you've had as Minister of Finance, and perhaps give us some light on how this introduction of this principle-based fiscal anchor could be aided by the Commission in whatever space. I mean, you have an understanding and an appreciation of the role that this Commission did under your tenure as Finance Minister. What are you hoping you can contribute towards solutioning towards this fiscal anchor?
Indeed, even though I don't have the details as yet, but such discipline in that space is quite relevant, and it's required. And it couldn't have been required at any time than now. Because, as you would know, in the monetary space, you have your inflation target as your anchor of a monetary policy. And therefore, I think it is critical that on the fiscal side, you also do have something that actually brings about that kind of discipline. That discipline should not restrain or restrict spending, but it should actually just provide the necessary safeguards in terms of how resources are deployed and how resources are spent, and also making sure that there is a meaningful impact of those resources where it matters most.
You find yourself on the other side of a conversation now that you are in an advisory capacity on the Commission. In the past, you have been receiving the advice from such a Commission. Are you at all concerned that being the one to now provide the advice might be a different conversation to have, perhaps with the current Finance Minister and any other Finance Minister that may come after this?
Well, that has been the story of my life. When I was a Member of Parliament, I was holding the Minister of Finance to account. And when I became Deputy Minister, after passing legislation also that gave powers to Parliament to be able to scrutinize and amend budgets, I found myself in the ministry. So it is the story of my life, of changing roles. And when the power relations change, the responsibility is that of actually making sure that we have one main objective, actually, of a successful South Africa, and in building our economy. I think at times, whatever experience and skills you developed in another role, they do come in handy in the other role, because you have an understanding of how the other side operates.
In building a proper and worthwhile South Africa, it is important to lend yourself to public service wherever you may be called upon to do so. All the best to you, kind sir, and to the commission that has been appointed by the president. That is the Financial and Fiscal Commission that has been recently announced, and we just had a conversation with the chairperson of that commission, Ntate Nhlanhla-Nene. Thank you so much, sir, and all the best to you and the team.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones, because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides, it's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
Spur Corporation Limited reported their full year's results for the financial year ended 30 June 2026. Revenues up 8.5% from a business perspective. Franchised turnovers up north of the 12 billion rand mark, and profits before tax, depending on which number you're looking at, north of the 300, possibly even 400 million rand mark. We're going to take a look at these numbers in more detail with the company's Group Chief Executive Officer, Val Nichas, who joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Val, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Another good year, another strong year, and I'm happy to see this year's performance very, very different from what we were dealing with back in COVID-19. The business really back in its stride and really doing well. What did you make of the year?
Good afternoon, Jimmy. Lovely to be on the call again. Yes, we're very grateful for the results, and we're very pleased that we've been blessed with the last 6 years of a good, solid performance for our group and our brands. So really exciting. Yes, COVID years are forgotten now, but it has been good, and we're very grateful for our customers who still vote with their feet and visit our restaurants regularly. So yes, happy with the results.
Well, let's take a look at that voting with their feet, because it's coming through in the numbers. Unrestricted cash at the end of the year, just shy, literally 7 million shy of the 500 million rand mark. This coupled with a overall debt on the balance sheet of under 25 million rand. The business definitely in a comfortable position by any metric, and from an operating perspective, return on equity north of 20%. Your balance sheet really shows that the business has done all it's needed to recover from those dire times. How is the management team feeling about having this much headroom?
We know that over the years we've made sure that we had liquidity in the business, and we know that over the period, obviously, we've looked at either cash buybacks or the investment that we made in the Doppio portfolio in December 23. So there has been some consideration of capital allocation, but as you know, we also had to make allowance and ensure we had funds available because of the litigation case that obviously was announced on the 7th of August. So yes, it's important for us. Obviously, the business does generate good cash every single year, and a lot of it obviously is paid out in dividends to our shareholders and tax, but we make sure that every year we are very responsible with how we invest and protect our cash holdings.
Well, let's take a look at that litigation provision in a bit more detail, because really, if we're looking at the numbers for this particular financial year, that is the only thing that has swung the numbers against the Spur Group. Almost 130 million rand provision there that's being set aside. That case is ongoing. I'm not going to expect you to comment on the developments of the case, but from a financial perspective, a prudent decision by the business to set those funds aside regardless of the outcome at this stage. The business, even with that 130 million rand set aside, still having its head well above water.
Yes. Look, the provision was necessary. We don't like it, but it's necessary. And it did impact our profit before tax if you take the provision into consideration, as well as our headline earnings per share. It didn't affect anything else in terms of our cash generated or return on equity. But the provision's there. We're going into appeal. So God willing, we'll see what the outcome is in February. The underlying performance, as you saw, was very solid, with most of our brands delivering a good performance.
Val, can we take a look at those brands in a bit more detail? Because the business has, over the years, been able to kind of build out different segments within the food segment as a whole. I mean, there's obviously the sit-down family side of things, there's the fast casual, there's the virtual brands. How have you been able to craft the architecture in a market that, one, is highly competitive, two, is saturated with many different brands? The Spur Corporation as a group has almost elevated itself to not just being one company, but being a holding company for all of these companies. How does that strategy play out now that you've still got the headroom to add to these brands, to add to the strategy? Are you looking at perhaps saying, let's start to diversify into more of the virtual side of it? Let's dig a little deeper into the fast casual businesses. How is this shaping your approach to your various portfolio assets?
So Jimmy, we've always approached our portfolio as a house of brands, playing probably in the mainstream to upper consumer family dining type environments, because our brands were about celebration, experiential, and family orientated. So that sort of sits at the core of the business, which is obviously led by Spur, followed by Panarottis, John Dory's, and then on the fast casual side with Rocamamas, that's spanning a little bit more of the fast casual. And then we know that consumers go up the ranks with their dining experiences. So they're not going to jump from QSR to a speciality, but from a, let's say, a mainstream family dining experience, they might move to a speciality restaurant like Doppio or Hussar Grill. So our brand portfolio is definitely in the arena of casual dining. So it's weighted service, but it's not necessarily fine dining. I think it's still approachable, affordable, and unintimidating. So that's how we've positioned our brands, with probably our biggest unique differentiator is brands that lead the experience. So at birthday, at Spur, it's about the birthday celebration, about the play areas. At Panarottis, it's about eating the pizza at the table, sharing experiences around a table, and the kids playing with dough or making their own pizza. Everything's around the experience. At Rocamamas, it's about your tick menu so you can customize your burger. The fact that you can use an alias name when you order, and then there's a bit of interaction with the waiter. So we've always built on that, and that's something that differentiates us. And our intent is to even elevate that even further, try and build the every touch point. We're building the experience on a new level. That's how we approach our brands. Are there other categories and channels? On channels, we're not going to become a QSR brand, but we recognize that our brands and our consumers want those signature items. They want the Durky wings, and they want the cheddar melt steak, and they want it wherever they are. So if they're on a couch, they want to order it through a delivery service. So that's why we have to engage in those, in the third-party aggregators, to get the product to the consumer. The virtual kitchen brands, I think, is a, I always call it the underground brands, because I think there are quite a lot of them. A lot of our brands have leveraged the opportunity to capitalize on the capacity in a restaurant. So for example, Panarottis runs the Pizza Pug brand, which is a virtual kitchen brand. And about 89% of Panarottis franchisees are also selling pizza on the Pizza Pug brand. So I think there's a market out there that wants something that's a little bit different. If it's the right price and the name and the product resonates with them, they'll order it again. So that's our approach. Our core business is casual dining, but we definitely want to be available to our customers on any channel they choose.
Elevating experiential dining experiences and listening to the consumers and the market in the process. The Spur Corporation firmly entrenching themselves as the home of good brands and reporting numbers that support that in great detail. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer of Spur Corporation Limited, Val Nichas, joining us to reflect on the positive year that they've had and where the business is headed to next.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. So at some point, we caught up with the Standard Bank Group around their smart ID-enabled branches. They were on a concerted drive to increase the number of branches that they had available to their clientele to make this process even easier. Initially, back in May of this year, the business had reached around 50 branches nationwide. That number has since doubled to 100. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Head of Fraud Operations, Client Experience and Risk Execution at Standard Bank South Africa's personal and private banking, Marius Leroux. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Marius, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. It's quite impressive that you were able to scale this operation so quickly in such a short space of time. How did the business kind of manage the scaling and get to this milestone so easily?
I think a lot of pre-planning. I must say the DHA, you know, together with the banks, we've put a lot of rigor into pre-testing, planning, designing. So a lot of it is, you know, making sure you've set the foundation right, you know, when we started in early March. And I think once you've got the blueprint, you've got clear plans, You know, we have to, you know, thank our provincial teams on the ground. You know, everything's planned out. You know, infrastructure is well planned ahead of time. And then it becomes just replicating the blueprint. And I think because the technology is so simplified and, you know, we can integrate fairly quickly, it's literally just, you know, training it. And the process of, you know, so well designed, you know, because it's digitized, it's easy for our staff to adopt, to get trained, and it executes, you know, within minutes, you know, from a client experience perspective. And I think that's given us momentum. And I think this has just allowed the plan to scale, you know, fairly quickly. And we're doing sort of, you know, 7, 8, 9 branches a week, you know, across the various provinces, and sometimes, you know, even a bit more than that. But yeah, definitely, you know, as it rolls out, you know, I think we've, you know, got our teams into a good rhythm now, you know, and it's again great collaboration between our internal teams as well as, you know, initially in our front, you know, with the DHA team, which I think has made this, you know, quite a success from that perspective. So now it's just, you know, almost as a business as usual element, and we're just sort of scaling it as we go and integrating it into our various branches.
Maurice, in a day where we're seeing banks increasingly moving towards more digital services, some banks in South Africa have taken the decision to close down branches instead of opening new ones. How important is it when we're looking at conversations like the unbanked community, those that don't have, underserved communities as well, that don't have access to these sorts of services, to be able to walk into their bank and say, I can access more than just my banking through this partnership with the Department of Home Affairs? For the Standard Bank Group, having that physical presence across the entire country, across the entire African continent, surely bodes well to being able to serve those communities.
Look, I think we realize that we have a diverse community. You know, many people are digitally fit, and many communities, and especially rural communities, are not. So I think we realize that we have to find that balance between sort of scaling and growing our infrastructure, you know, through our various points of representation, and also taking services like this, you know, that wouldn't be available to many of the clients in rural environments that are also, one, you know, not digitally fit, you know, so some are elderly, and sometimes they need that additional assistance, both, you know, from a you know, ID application, but also in a just general banking perspective. And I think we've realized that we have to sort of give customers choice in terms of either digital or, you know, still a branch environment, you know, for certain, you know, services, you know, that they do require that are critical. And I think this is what we see as one of the critical services, especially to convert from a green ID. You know, I mean, you know, if you walk into any environment, you need an ID card, you know, you need your biometrics and loaded with DHA, you know, whether you apply for a job, whether you're a first time matriculant, you know, whether you travel, etc. So, you know, all of those things are critical elements of, you know, defining, you know, just basic services that are available for you to also get service delivery for other things that are important to you. So I think we've seen this as a value added services, you know, through our branch network, and we'll continue to expand it, you know, in different forms. Yeah.
I must confess to the SAFM community, I have stood in a Standard Bank line, but it was to get a passport done many, many years ago, and the service was remarkably efficient. It was well over 10 years ago at this point, so I know that these sorts of private-public partnerships have definitely benefited the South African public in the past. But Maurice, I want to take a look at how it is that we continue with these partnerships and these collaborations, perhaps even to expanding into additional services. Yes, I touched on the passport services. Yes, this is primarily dealt with from a smart ID perspective, but the integration then obviously allows for the bank to be able to securely assist customers with a lot more than just smart IDs in the future.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think the minister said it on the 22nd of July in his formal publication. You know, the next step in the next coming months before the end of the year will definitely be passport applications and renewals. And, you know, we can't wait for that. I think, you know, currently we have 9 DHA sites attached to our branches, you know, where you have to make an appointment ahead of time, etc., and pay ahead of schedule. And then also, obviously, you can go to certain DHA sites. Now it gives us the ability to scale, you know, the ability to apply for a passport, you know, on a walk-in basis across almost, you know, the whole country. We'll obviously do that strategically based on, you know, sort of the how the clients are, you know, spread demographically. But I think, you know, that's just one. I think if you think about, you know, first-time ID holders, if you have to write matric, you might have to travel kilometers now to go and get your first ID application to write your end-of-year exams. You know, now you can just walk into your closest branch almost and get your first-time ID done, you know, as well as, you know, which is coming downstream, you know, also before the end of this year. And I think with the minister, you know, the evolution of that, you know, now that we've set the foundation, I think we'll continue to support that journey. And I think, you know, his vision, you know, is to offer a lot more digital services around, you know, IDs and passports, etc. So we, you know, we're more than, you know, happy to continue on that journey, and we're quite excited about it. Yeah, but I think to your point, you know, this is for us a great value add, you know, to the community, and Yeah, we can't wait to expand it into the additional services throughout this year and in coming years to come.
Marius, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the progress that the bank has achieved up to this point. A little over 50,000 Smart ID applications have been processed, and you just touched on the fact that as we continue to roll out the next phases of this, we're hoping that that increases and that we improve the accessibility towards government services. How important is it for the Standard Bank Group to be able to leverage their network in providing these sorts of services, not just from a Department of Home Affairs perspective, but just for the needs of the clientele that you have as those needs change from a day-to-day basis?
I think it's for us, you know, customers are at the forefront of what we do, you know, first and foremost. I think if you look at, you know, we spoke about Oogie Branch in one of the recent articles. I mean, you either have to travel to Mtata or you have to travel to Maclear, which is 25 or 86 kilometers away. And, you know, look at Tiernison, Ladysmith, you know, there's Oudtshoorn, where customers would have had to travel 60, 70 kilometers to DHA. Now we're bringing it within your doorstep. So the convenience of bringing that to clients, you know, I think in terms of adding value and just you're giving them the basic thing like an ID book, you know, is fundamental for us. I think it helps reduce fraud in terms of clients, you know, being able to be biometrically enrolled, you know, not having the green ID book. So for us, I think, you know, we just think this is a critical component that we don't just see it as, you know, a service to continue the green ID, but we still see this as a great value add. You know, it enables us to do AML, KYC, you know, to continue to sell to clients when they do engage with us frequently on this basis and add, you know, sort of also inquire about other things that they may need from the bank on a regular basis. So, yeah, we definitely see this way beyond. And I think you're bringing it to communities where communities have had to spend two or three taxi rides or train rides, et cetera, to get to, you know, certain of the sites. I think scaling it, you know, just making it accessible, we just think it's an amazing, you know, initiative that we've been able to be part of and, you know, to bring value to clients and to bring services that, you know, that they've been, you know, let's call it far-reached, you know, from them to be able to access that now and, you know, just, you know, walk into a branch and literally get that service within 6 or 7 minutes, you know, is amazing. And I think we've gone from 100, I think we're now sitting at 119 branches. We got 7 going live. We had 126 for this week. And yeah, I think, you know, the sky's the limit. I think we're there to support the minister and his target of, you know, a couple of 100,000 a year as we try and close out and reduce the green ID books in the system. So yeah, we're quite excited about it and great that we're adding value to our clients.
Adding value and bringing services to clients where they need it most, the Standard Bank Group and their partnership with the Department of Home Affairs in increasing the amount of smart ID-enabled branches, crossing the 100-branch threshold. We're over 126 branches already by the end of this particular phone call, and by the time this conversation goes to air, we may be over 130. And Marius Leroux, Head of Fraud Operations, Client Experience and Risk Execution at Standard Bank South Africa's Personal and Private Banking Division, joining us to take a look at their Smart ID initiative and how it is that that's been rolling out. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter, but that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
Exxaro Resources Limited released today their interim results for 6 months ended June 30, 2026, an interim dividend slightly lower than the previous first half of the 2025 financial year. Revenues are up about 7%, profits down ever so slightly. We're going to take a look at these numbers in greater detail with the company's Chief Executive Officer, Ben Magara, who joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Uncle Ben, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Stronger revenue numbers up 7% in a tough economic environment. Profits down ever so slightly, and I say ever so slightly because still above the 4 billion rand mark, and that's quite impressive considering the macro factors out there. How have you found the start of the new financial year?
Good talking to you, Jimmy, as always. Very tough dynamics in the market, and the global volatility, the uncertainty in the globe has really impacted commodities, even though we were in a way our production came out through very strongly. Starting off with safety, we improved our safety performance by 60% in terms of lost time injury frequency rate. But I talk about this, Jimmy, because safety tends to be a precursor for good production. So we saw production going up 11%. Our export sales, realizing the higher coal prices, went up 15%. So we've really delivered good operational performances across the line in coal. In renewable energy, we went up 12% because our solar plant came to life in Lephalale, supplying our mine GG. And our manganese for the first time is now in our contributions and operating profits with an 11% improvement in production. So really that's the result of why revenue has gone up 7%. EBITDA is essentially flat at 5.6 billion, even though the EBITDA in coal went up 5%, renewable energy went up 2%. We had what I would call the once-off acquisition costs for the manganese transaction. And that's why our EBITDA numbers are essentially flat, as you highlighted, even though net cash went up 15% to 6.4 billion. So a great performance, and very proud that we could deliver a 47th consecutive dividend of 7 rands per share. But you hinted on the headline earnings per share, which I think I should cover, where because of the associates, especially Sishen Iron Ore Company and Black Mountain, their performance reflected in our headline earnings because all the dividends we get out of there come into Exxaro's numbers.
Uncle Ben, let's take a look at the manganese acquisition in a bit more detail. Diversification starting to become a growing theme. Exxaro still very much proud of its coal operations and doing exceptionally well, north of the 20 million ton in terms of production volumes. But I want to get your thoughts around that manganese business and how that's going to start to add in its own flavor into the portfolio mix for Exxaro. This is but potentially the first of many acquisitions if this works out the way you intend. Is the business interested in potentially going down this rabbit hole in a bit more detail, or are you happy with kind of getting a feel of the manganese space and seeing if it lines up with the business?
It lines up with the business very well. It's bulk mining. It's very dependent on logistics, and our engagements with Transnet are very helpful. And our mining capabilities are very transferable into manganese. And we have a joint venture structure that works well for us. The acquisitions have made us the fourth largest producer in manganese globally. And with 80% of the manganese in the country, we think there is scope for us to even become more significant and to be a market leader in this space. And our aspirations are going to be supported by the Mokala transaction, which we are busy finalizing with Glencore as we speak now. So our interest is to really integrate manganese as part of a key profit and loss account in Exxaro, and we're on our path there for the growth that we are seeing in that market. And the long-term fundamentals are robust. The CP mine we acquired has got 190 million tons of reserves and resources, and at 3.5 million tons a year, maybe four, there is real prospects for the future and growth within the Exxaro portfolio.
Uncle Ben, let's take a look at how the rest of that portfolio could potentially shape up as we go into the second half of the year. Production numbers estimated to be around that 42 million ton level from a coal production perspective. I want to get your thoughts around a market that has at times been highly unforgiving on the coal price side of things, which is completely out of your control, but a market that you've been able to persevere in and really maintain your costs. How is your outlook going into the second half of the year being influenced around that coal price and the coal market, and perhaps some of the geopolitical factors around the world that might be influencing that?
Currently, we still see attractive coal prices as long as we can continue to have good performance from Transnet that we have seen in this half. We have guided that we are likely to be exporting between 7.3 and 8 million tons. We exported 3.9 in this half, and we expect those numbers. So we have reiterated our production teams are doing well. They continue to manage costs. I think diesel prices may impact a little bit more than we have seen, because I think the increases in diesel prices came in almost about halfway through the first half. And in this second half, there will be more embedded for the full year. But we have reiterated our production numbers both in coal and in manganese. And we think that that is still deliverable, including the sustaining capital, the renewable energy business. We have dropped the target a little bit, maybe more towards the lower end, which is 800 to 830 gigawatt hours. But we're really confident and are really cautiously optimistic with the good safety performance continues to translate to good production, to good cost management. We have to continue to do more.
Continuing to do more, as the year is not done just yet, which means the work of the Exxaro Resources Limited team is not over just yet, and that is the focus going into the second half of their financial year. We'll see how the rest of that year does indeed shape up. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer at Exxaro Resources, Ben Magara, joining us to reflect on the first half of their new financial year.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It is SME of the Week time, and we're going to be speaking to a company by the name of Mobilize. I'm joined on the line by the company's founder and chief executive officer, Sean Doherty, to take a look at his business and get a sense of how he built it. Sean, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about Mobilize. What do you do as a business, and how did the business come about?
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. Just one correction. I'm not the founder, but I am the CEO and a shareholder. Mobilize, it's been around for a little bit less than 30 years. It started actually as a business called A1 Taxi, and it financed minibus taxis. That's how it started. It subsequently has grown to finance and insure, repair, maintain, have rewards programs around the minibus taxi sector. So it's grown substantially over those 28 to 30 years. At the moment, what we do is, obviously, we're still very involved in taxi. We are a SME mobility play. So we look at either financing or insuring mobility assets, which are also SMEs. So taxi is the obvious one. I guess e-hailing is another one which would come to mind immediately. And then a second part of our business is we do a lot of work for big financial institutions, banks in the country, where we almost do their back office in their vehicle asset finance businesses. So whether that is help them collect from their customers or help them do other things, which maybe we could just do a little bit cheaper or faster, that's what we do at the moment.
Sean, why the mobile services or the mobility sector, rather? What about that sector, especially from an insurance perspective, makes sense for a business like Mobilize?
Well, look, so we obviously come out of the minibus taxi space. I mean, that is our bread and butter, and that is obviously the foundation of our business. And there's probably a couple of things, there are probably exactly two things, which we see in the taxi space. One, taxis, as we know, they move majority of our population, but they aren't the only source of mobility that do that. And two, in the taxi space, which we also see in things like e-hailing, we see them in small logistics businesses, we see them in staff transport businesses, is that you have a lot of entrepreneurs in these businesses who don't necessarily have access to finance and to insurance to grow their businesses and to keep expanding their businesses. So we very much are a business that, as I say, we are in that mobility space. We help people almost become banked. So we, I guess over time, our expectation is that as people sort of move into financial services, as they use us to grow, ultimately they will graduate into the big banks, but we are their first step into financial services. So that financial inclusion piece from mobility is really important, because if there's no mobility, nobody's getting to work.
Sean, that mobility sector is undergoing potentially some significant changes if we think about the fact that we've seen the introduction of electrified vehicles in that space, both from an e-hailing perspective and also from a minibus taxi perspective. How does a proposition like that affect your value proposition as an insurer in how you treat those assets perhaps, or how you treat those markets, and how is it that you think you could add to the services that you offer at the moment?
So Jimmy, I think so both on our finance side and our insurance side, but also we have an assembly side of our business. We I think we add value to people who are bringing EVs into the country or manufacturing EVs. We add value across the whole value chain. From an insurance side, it's going to be very, very interesting as to how we think about insurance of the battery versus insurance of the chassis, and we are sort of working on that. I think the finance side, similarly, how do you think about financing a battery? Is it sort of a rent-to-buy model? Is it a pure rental model versus a chassis on a normal installment sale agreement? So I think there's work to do there. But ultimately, when people buy these EVs and when people insure them, often they're going to buy them with finance. We are there to provide that finance. And if they need to insure them, we're there to insure them. Again, like I will just say, our niche is we are very, very good at understanding sort of risk in these SME mobility spaces. So we would never be able to compete with your big insurance companies. But when it comes to managing a perception of risk, we are sort of very, very good at that. So we'll add value across that whole chain. I think in the finance space, especially when it comes to these SMEs and how they are financed, it's going to be very interesting. We do see that one of the big hurdles for an SME to get finance is a deposit. Normal asset finance, you would want a deposit. So how do you think about that when the cost of your income earning asset is probably going to, if not double, probably go up by about 160 to 170%. And I think financial innovation around that's going to be really important. And that's sort of a big strength of ours.
Sean, before I let you go, how is it that people can get in touch with you? If I'm a small business or small business owner, I'm looking for potentially some of the insurance services that you guys have on offer. How is it that I reach out to the Mobilize team and set up some time with you guys?
So we're on all sort of, I guess, social media handles, and we are, our website is probably the easiest way to get hold of us. And we'll come straight back to whoever wants to sort of do business with us or inquire as to how we can help them make their business more sustainable and more profitable.
Helping businesses achieve greater profitability and ensuring that the right insurance cover is in place as well. The team at Mobilize are ready to assist the mobility sector of South Africa. Mobilize, spelled Mobalyz.com. That is their website. All the best to you and the team, Sean. Folks, just a small disclaimer here. It is an insurance business, and it is a regulated insurance business. I did go and verify that. Thank you so much, Sean, to you and to your services that you offer into the market. All the best to the Mobilize business. That's the SME of the week. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're running a business, you know the sound. That's growth. Another customer. Money in the bank. Why should your business slow down for your bank? With Capitec Business, it doesn't. You get lower fees, faster credit approvals, and bankers who know your business. Now that's progress. Bank on better with Capitec Business Banking. Capitec is an authorized credit provider, FSP 46669. Initiation, service fees, and conditions apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the update for the show, folks. That's the update for the week. If you've missed any of the conversations, you can catch up on them as podcasts. It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Host and the SFM News team are standing by with the latest round of evening news. Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team will follow thereafter. From my side, at least for tonight, good night.